To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Dig Deep Grow, the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. We're going to be talking about a little bit about business and a bit about living from your heart. In today's world, if you can't bring the two together, you're going to have a hard row of it. So we'll be talking with Randy Lewis, who has a book called No Greatness Without Goodness. And I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction for Randy here. Randy's a former vice president at Walgreens, the national pharmaceutical or pharmacy chain. And Randy took the company from, I believe it was 1,500 locations to over 8,000 locations as a logistics director. So this man has a experience both in the business world, but for this book, Randy focuses on his relationship with his son, his family, and how that relationship transformed his life and his business life as well. So, Randy, thank you for joining me today.
It's great to be here, Michael.
All right. So can you say, talk a little about, at the time that your son was born, were you at Walgreens at that time? What was the... just give us a little background.
Sure. I had been a consultant for 17 years, and then I had just joined Walgreens when our son was born. He was about a year old when I joined Walgreens. So at about age three, and we have three children. He's our middle child. About age three, he got diagnosed with autism, which kind of set us back on our heels. And it started... It started us down a road we have never believed we would have gone down. And we certainly wouldn't have gone down if we had any choices about it.
Yeah. So talk about the early days and how that impacted your ability to work and, the stress that you may have been feeling in your life. How were you able to cope?
Well, this was, the only thing we knew about autism when Austin got his diagnosis was that we were afraid of it. We didn't know much about it. Little did we know that he was probably part of this wave now that affects one out of, I think they're saying, 70 children born around the world. At that moment, we realized we joined a club that we didn't want to join, but one thing that all parents who have a child with disability share is realizing that they only have so much time on this earth, and they start worrying about what's going to be happening to my children, and especially those with the disabilities, because we know what they're going to face. And there's a lot of fear around that. What are we going to do? We lay abed at night and say, maybe if we could just live one day longer than our son or our daughter. And it pretty much set us back on our heels. We didn't know what we were facing. We had visions of a future where I'd be having to hold him down and get his hair cut, and knowing that one day he would be bigger and stronger than me, or that would he be living with us the rest of his life? What kind of life would he have? And I think that that bears heavily on parents, as it did us, not knowing what we were facing. And one of the early decisions that we made was one thing that we wanted to integrate him into the family. A lot of people do. They jump through all kinds of hoops, and thank goodness they do, to search out the cures and the latest treatments, and we learn from all them. But we had two other children at home, and that was not an option for us. So Austin entered the school system at age three, and he's now 26, and he stayed in the school system for all the way until the time he was 21. He was one of the first kids with autism to stay in the school system. The special ed teacher told us at the time, as it was the director saying, yes, I'm the new director of special ed, but I've looked around and we don't have many people that have very big challenges. We tend to send folks like your son out of our district to get specialized training, but these are our own children. We want to do something in our own school district. So he was an early guinea pig in that, and I would have to say for Austin that worked out well. We all learned together.
Was that an assistant? I mean, was the school was open to it then, right? It wasn't that you had to convince anyone.
No, I think they wanted the because we had somebody new in that position, and was ready to take that challenge. And so Austin was an experiment all the way through. You know, some things we had to fight for, and sometimes parents underestimate their own children, and sometimes teachers underestimate their. So it's trial and error on both sides, but we kind of work together. And for example, learning to drive. My son knows how to drive. He got a driver's license, which would have been unheard of years earlier. And he's probably the first kid with autism in the school district that learned to drive mm-hmm. at the level of his autism.
Mm-hmm.
But he went through the class twice with the help of a lot of fantastic teachers and patient teachers and passed his driver's test the first time. Of course, he learned illegally, like every kid does, illegally with their parents driving them through the neighborhood at night. That was a lot. He had a lot of practice runs, but and he drives me to the airport. He's my chauffeur to the airport whenever I have to go.
Wow. So at the time that Austin was born, autism was not a well-known illness. Is that how you saw it, or you know, give me the
well. Our only exposure is occasionally there'd be a character. Back in the day, there was a show called San Elsewhere, and there was a child of one of the main characters who had autism, and it was very scary. He didn't speak. He had tantrums, all kinds of odd behavior, and that was our vision of it. And at the time Austin was diagnosed, the belief was it was 1 out of 100,000. So it's changed a lot over those 23 years since his diagnosis. Go to from 1 in 100,000, they thought, to be 1 in 70.
Yeah. So at the time, you were dealing with the family situation and adjustments there. You're also taking on a new job at Walgreens and obviously stayed with the company for many years. Can you talk about, you know, the effect that your son's illness early on had on your ability to be effective at work?
Well, I think, and I think other parents, it's not necessarily just autism, it's the same thing. The clock starts ticking. One is the one you know how much time you got on this earth, and the other is how's your child going to be? And if you're at home, where is he? Because you're really worried about him getting out, so he's always on top of mind. But I think even being the dad and working outside the home, and my wife was staying at home with all our children, she bore a lot of the brunt of that every day. I got to escape to a world that would be quite a distraction. Mothers tend to bear a lot of that load, and you know, thanks be to God, my wife, it brought us closer together. A lot of times this tears the stress of the situation is a big factor in breakups, just because it doesn't get resolved. And sometimes there are no great happy endings. And the worry about happy endings is the stress it brings. And we had that.
Right.
The day of the diagnosis, I went back to the office and I got a piece of paper and I printed out this prayer I'd heard from Dag Hammarskjöld, the General Secretary of the UN, when I was a kid. And it summed up exactly where I was. And the prayer is very simple. For all that has been, thank you. And for all that will be, yes. That was about as much hope as I could muster. Mm-hmm. If I could just say yes to this future that we're facing, not knowing what it was. That was kind of generally my state of mind. I have no idea how this is going to turn out.
Right. Yeah. Was there a moment in time where you really felt that you had gotten to a certain point where you didn't feel that level of, like, uncertainty?
uncertainty on the bad or uncertainty on the good?
I would say, that's a very interesting perspective. I would say on the bad first, but, you know, the positive surprises as well.
Well, Austin didn't, we didn't know he was ever going to speak. He didn't speak until he was age 10.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing, having to figure out to see the person underneath all that challenge he had was a struggle. Did he love us? What is he thinking about? I remember my wife and I talking about a Spock on Star Trek who could put his hands on somebody's side of their head meld their mind with them so they could understand what was going on. We said, gee whiz, of all the things we could wish for, that's what I'd wish, is to, what is he thinking? And that was difficult. And we wondered if he never spoke, that would limit him a lot. If, gee whiz, we weren't even thinking about him being able to drive at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the not knowing, the things that you worry about that haven't happened yet, tended to be worse than the things that actually did happen.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, we would say, and so we got to the point somewhere along before 10 years, because we would see other parents with different struggles, and we would say to ourselves, we have no problems. You know, if we had to draw from the beans of bad luck, there are a lot worse beans than the ones we drew. And that helped us a bit.
Mm-hmm.
That helped remind us that there are a lot of other people that struggle with a lot worse cases than we do, even if our son doesn't talk.
Right.
We have a family that's together. We have a certain amount of means to deal with it. We have faith. There's lots of things that we have. And we just got to hold on to our strengths before we let all the worries that we can't deal with, you know, just consume us.
Right. Yeah. The worry of the future, the worry of the past, kind of clouds the present. And what you just said is that you were better off not to engage anything that you didn't have control over.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the things that we worried about cutting his hair. Well, it took probably 50 times in the barber shops of just sitting there, and then the barber just putting scissors around his head, and then putting clippers, electric clippers, around his head before they were touched. So,
mm-hmm.
But that happened. What we wish we had thought about was, wish we didn't have, wouldn't have let him eat so much pizza, and taught him to like broccoli.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we'd have been better off working on the broccoli and the vegetables than we had worried about some of the other things that
right. Didn't
happen.
Yeah, that came along. The dietary recommendations, that all came along a little later, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So in your book, you've got 44 chapters, and I think they're small lessons. Would that be accurate?
I'd say yes.
All right. Okay. So could you relay a couple of your favorites in there just so that people have a flavor for, you know, what you're offering in the book?
Well, what the challenge I had with the book, and it was kind of fun to do, when I was talking to the publishers, you know, I'd written the story out, and they said, well, why don't you shorten up some of these chapters and put a lesson at the end of each one, because the primary audience of this may be business. And business likes short, business readers tend to like short chapters, and they like a little lesson, but you got to keep the narrative running.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not easy to come up with 44 lessons or 41 lessons in there,
mm-hmm.
that tie back to the narrative, you know, because you kind of, a lot of things have been said. My favorite ones are that when you decide to do something good, you'll be surprised that people have been preparing to join you. You know, when we launched an effort that I'm sure we're going to talk about, I was surprised that we'd come across strangers that we would never anticipated, who came in at the right time and helped us out. I also remember learning that, oh, but if you're going to be a leader, you need to manage. I had to manage my own fear and not so much worry about others' fear. If I could manage my fear, how could they manage theirs? And as leader, I had to assume established that the standard of performance is to do the best we can and not worry about failure, because we fail all the time. And we make mistakes, we move forward. That was a huge lesson.
Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. There came a time at Walgreens where there was an opportunity to make changes that really were highly unusual in corporate America, especially for publicly traded companies. Can you talk a little about your role in bringing the disability theme to the workplace?
Well, it's kind of odd. Here in one side of my life, my personal life, I have this son. I have three children. Worrying about my son, what's going to happen to him. And the biggest concern would be about a job, because a job could change the arc of a life. Driving, for us, we were saying, he was living in the suburbs. He could drive. That'd be like graduating summa cum laude from MIT, let's say. But gee whiz, if he had a job, that'd be like winning a Nobel Prize. That would give independence. That would give him a future, the ability to control aspects of life that he otherwise, not to be so dependent upon the kindness of strangers, social system, a place where he could have friends. That was on one side of my life, but on my business side of my life, professional life, here I am, the senior vice president of Vision, 10,000 people, and we're growing as a chain, and we're hiring almost 1,000 people a year. We have jobs. And got to thinking, gee whiz, we have jobs. I've learned so much from my son about, I've always underestimated the capability of what he could. If you had asked me, could people with autism work effectively in a distribution center before I had my son, I would have said no. But after watching him, seeing him develop in different ways, I had to ask myself, I had been not only my son short, but all those classrooms, all kinds of disabilities were soul short. And oh, by the way, in my role, being given this position of power, what am I going to do about it? If I couldn't do about it, knowing about it, and having the opportunity for hiring, who did we think would? So that's where the idea kind of formulated.
Right. So you had to bring this idea to the other leaders at work. And can you talk a little about whether that was an easy go in the, early on or not?
Well, the wonderful thing about hindsight, you don't remember all the difficult places. You just remember all the. So that's part of human nature. But certainly there were skeptics. I was fortunate. We had established a track record of success. We had built four huge automated distribution centers back to back, and we had some time to consider how we were going up the game, so to speak. We were going to even make it more automated, more efficient than ever. And I just presented the idea, saying perhaps we're going to have to redesign our system, everything anyway. Perhaps if we just take in mind a group of people with disabilities, all kinds of disabilities, how could we modify this in such a way at no extra cost so that it would enable a group of people with disabilities to work, people with autism or limited motion, et cetera, just to open up our eyes. And I think, and we also said, oh, by the way, because of our business, we're not going to try to be charity here. We're going to have to. We make only 3 cents on the dollar. We have competitors. We have shareholders. What we're going to do is we're not going to change any of our standards of performance. We're going to have everybody the same standards. Everybody's going to work side by side. Everybody's going to work for the same pay. No us, them. In a completely inclusive environment. Mm-hmm. I think that captures a lot of people's imaginations and also satisfied a lot of those doubts. Because we said, oh, by the way, does not work, we'll adjust,
mm-hmm.
just like we do in other aspects of business. And I think that's what got a lot of people over the hump. And the other part, people wanted this to work. And when we said that we do one-third of the workforce, that was a dream that nobody could have ever imagined. because nobody in the world has ever built a $180 million mission-critical plant with a specific intent to hire people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
that was a pretty big thing, too. And so, but that was a pretty big challenge. I think it got a lot of people's imagination.
Yeah, the when I read the figure about one-third of the workforce, I thought, wow, that is aggressive. Is that how some other people saw it, or was it just, hey, this sounds like it would work?
Well, it sounds like it would work, and then we just had to figure out the story around it to make it really sound like it would work. But we thought autism would be a difficult disability to employ because of communication, some of the behavioral things. So we had an expert that we engaged, a fellow named James Emmett, who had worked a lot of people with autism. We asked him, saying, now, James, we're not going to have a lot of special job coaches because, again, we don't want to spend a lot of extra money on this. But how many typically abled, what we're called, nobody calls us people without disabilities normal anymore, look around the office, tell that that's not an appropriate word, how many typically abled team members would I need to support a person, say, with autism? He said two, so that's how we got the number. One out of three would be a person with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to set the goal high because we wanted people to know that we're going to do this with specific intent, and we have got to open up our imagination if we're going to be successful to even get close to that.
And how long did this take, Randy, from the inception, the idea to actually having it in the flesh, so to speak?
But that first building with those kind of numbers, we started planning. Building takes 2 years to build, takes about a year to plan. So we took about 3 years before the building opened. But along the way, we started making plans. Matter of fact, we picked the community we were going to build it in, Anderson, South Carolina, based on talking to the economic community, saying, do you have supports for people with disabilities, and you can help us find and train a workforce? And most economic development communities had not ever heard that question when a prospective employer is coming in to open up a plant. So that we happened to pick a right community, and our partner there, eventual partner, said, yes, I can do that. Although he said later he had no idea he would be able to do it. But if he waited 35 years for that phone call, he sure was not going to say no, but he was able, as did the community. And we had people, once the word got out that we were looking for people with disabilities, we had people move across the country just to start living in the community, establish their citizenship, and start work training center on their own time just for the opportunity to apply.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So a lot of things were going on while we were building it. It opened in 2007. And it was a huge success.
And it
became our most productive building in the history of our company.
Wow.
The only thing the board has said since then is, thank you. Now it's not one out of three. It's not 30%. That building is 40%. The building we opened 2 years later became 50% of the workforce. Then we realized it wasn't about all that fancy automation we put in. It was about the will and the willingness to do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
Spread across all 20 centers we had, where over 10% of our workforce, over 1,000 people with disabilities, are employed across the country in our distribution centers.
Mm-hmm.
We said we were going to open it up to the world, and others have come and seen it and copied the model.
So in the work environment, what were the lessons that those with disabilities taught those without disabilities? Because in your example, you increased the percentage of those with disabilities, so obviously the performance, they were outperforming, correct?
Certainly. When we measured performance per se, strict performance, it was the same. Statistically, it was the same, which was fantastic. What we found out, that safety was better twice. We had cost of an accident for first ability was half what it was with typically able. That's a significant thing. that our retention was significantly better. Our absenteeism was twice as low for people with disabilities. And it had an impact on those without disabilities. The teamwork we've had in the building, the impact on management. Management will say, gee whiz, my job has always been about production, quality, and timeliness. We know that. But now my job has really gotten bigger. My job is to make everyone around me successful. And that is lightning in a bottle if you have that in the work environment where management views its job to make everybody, disability or no disability, successful. And so I think that's why we expanded it.
Yeah.
And plus, we shortchanged a lot of people. We thought we were aiming high with a third. We realized that we're even pessimists. We didn't think that people with disabilities could move around to different jobs. We thought they might like repetitive jobs. Well, guess what? When we first opened up and had startup problems around all the automation, we had to throw those rules out the, or those preconceptions out the window. So even we aimed low at one out of three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just made a point about the people, the workforce, and you know, having you know, just the confidence in them. At the end of one of your chapters, chapter 23, you have a saying, which, by the way, is at the end of each of these chapters. This one says, help people see themselves in the story, and it will become their story, too. Can you relate that to what was going on in that first plant?
Well, I think everybody, when we first told people we were going to hire a lot of people with disabilities, a lot of people, I'm worried about making a mistake. I have a lot of apprehension. What if we mess up? Or what if we have to, somebody's not successful and we have to terminate them? I think the first thing we told everybody was saying, well, what would you do if you made a mistake with a typically disabled person? And they said, well, I'd do this. Well, it probably worked for a person with a disability. Or if we have to terminate somebody, and a lot of companies come in and that's a question they want to ask. How do you terminate somebody if they're not successful? And our very wise manager, I remember him telling that employer, saying, how do you terminate somebody without a disability? You do it the same way. You do it with concern and care, and it's a factual thing, and it's not a happy thing. That's the way we should do it. Everybody started seeing themselves in each other. For example, we don't connect through our strengths. That's one thing I've observed. When we put our suits on and get together and we talk about our work, we've got our shields and armor. It's kind of like it goes back to feudal days. We're like knights around the table. We have these masks on. But when you see somebody with the challenge, somebody say, well, we don't feel pity. But we do. We see ourselves. We see our own weakness. And that's how we connect. And I think that's what's happened. That's why we get so excited about it. We all fight a hard battle.
Right.
And when we see somebody else winning theirs, it gives us hope for winning our own battle.
Now, this all happened in 2007. And can you talk a little about what happened with other companies inquiring? You're obviously, a trailblazer. And so you had a lot of interest from other companies, I'm sure, just to find out what worked, what didn't. How have things changed in corporate America after this?
Well, we knew that was one of the things we said, we're going to open our doors and share everything we've learned with other companies. And we invite them to come in, and we still love other companies to come. And we show them everything we've done. We've even conduct some boot camps or inclusion universities where they can get hands-on. A lot of the companies have done that. Best Buy has done it and launched their new e-commerce center in Louisville. It's 50% people with disabilities. Lowe's, they've rolled this out in all their centers. Meijer up here in the Midwest is doing the same thing. Procter & Gamble is trying to roll this across all their plants. Marks & Spencer in the UK, a large company in the UK, is doing this. ICA, the largest grocer in Sweden. Futura, a Brazilian company, and Toys R Us. UPS, lots of companies. And I think it's an idea whose time has come. You need more examples.
Well, from your description of things, it sounds like it would be a no-brainer because it may have enhanced the output of the workforce rather than what most people might have thought, you know, which, you know, trying
well,
to...
My other peers would agree with that. But the unfortunate thing, we will take people come down and see it, and we call it the Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus Tour. Because first of all, you don't see anybody with disability. You see people doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets people excited. But even though we show people the numbers, we have the testimony of the managers. We publish the numbers. We've done everything we can to say this works. You don't want to go somewhere else and look at it. Lowe's will tell you the same thing. Best Buy will tell you. Only one out of 50 companies will do it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it does require making some changes, not expensive changes, but doing things differently. And I've come to the conclusion there are differences. There are leaders. There are leaders.
So the book is called No Greatness Without Goodness. I'm speaking with Randy Lewis. Randy, we have a couple of minutes left in our interview. So since the book has been released, tell me, you know, if you've seen any kind of a difference in new approaches from other companies, anything about the release of the book that has surprised you?
What has surprised me is all the letters I have got from people. That's what it reminds me when we first opened up the building. I would get letters from all across the country, and I'd be surprised people telling me their story and wanting to do something about this and being reminded of there is some other employers of other employees. Employers probably know about it. I'm surprised at the number of leaders who are writing me. I have been looking for some. Or young people saying, how do I make a difference in this world? That's been very gratifying and surprising. I don't have all great answers either.
Well, I think that you've revealed through your process, you've revealed that there's diamonds that were in the rough and that they're coming to the fore with this whole movement. And so I think it's a wonderful thing. It's just part of what's going on. I think with corporate America, there are some big changes that I've felt have been going on, especially in the last decade or so. So things are looking pretty good, I think, the way that corporate America is handling things these days. There's a lot of naysayers, a lot of people who will offer negatives about business, about corporate America, but the fact is that these are also the people that are making the changes that no one else really has the muscle to do. And so I think that that's a real positive thing, and I commend you for your effort in that movement.
Well, thank you, Michael.
So, Randy, thank you for joining me today. This is a great book. It's got lots of wisdom in it. Each chapter has a lesson. So, it's the kind of book where you don't have to read it from cover to cover. You can open it up anywhere and get some wisdom for the moment. So, it's just one of those books. I think this is a great one. You should find this at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, any of the major bookstores. So, Randy, again, thank you for coming on and sharing your story.
It was great to be here. Thank you so much.